The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show as we kick off yet another week. Hopefully, everyone had a nice and productive weekend. Well, we've got a lot to get to today, and I thought I'd just begin with some stats. Some of these you're familiar with if you've been listening to the shows at the top of the week the last few weeks. But firstly, for just this past weekend, the video that we played over here on the UK stations, The Sin of Self-Righteousness, that was posted at thetrumpet.com on Friday, a program in which we offered the Overcomer booklet, and also, for the first time, at least here in the UK, my father's booklet, John's Gospel, The Love of God, those two books. And in response to that program, we had 166 requests come in. 166. Now, just to help us appreciate how strong the responses have been the last few weeks, if you go back the week before this past weekend, that was the video on Is This Progress? We advertised the What Science Can't Discover About the Human Mind and the Wonderful World Tomorrow booklet. That brought in 195 requests, counting the ones that trickled in over the past week. 195. And then before that, you remember the second repeat, in fact, of the most important book since the Bible. That brought in 279 requests to become our most popular program yet, at least in terms of requests that have come in. 279 on the weekend of April 2nd and 3rd. And then before that, March 26th and 7th, you have the program Your Time is Your Life. We advertised The Last Hour and the Seven Laws of Success booklet. I think the Seven Laws of Success was offered for the first time here in the UK. That brought in 207 requests. And then before that, we advertised Pagan Holidays or God's Holy Days, which, and that too was a repeat program, and that repeat brought in 175 total requests. And then finally, this takes us back 6 weeks now to March 12th, March 13th, The Crisis at the Close, the program that set an all-time record, at least until the Mystery of the Ages repeat ran 3 weeks later. But that brought in 266 requests. So the 166 that we took in from this past weekend was actually our lowest in 6 weeks. I mean, that's how strong the responses have been in the last month and a half, to where now you get 166, and that's the low point for a six-week period. Last year, in the 52 weeks that we had programs on the air, 52 programs, of those 52, only 10 generated more than 166 responses. We had only 5 last year that generated more than 200. That's the stats from a 52-week bracket, 2015. 10 programs with 166 or more requests and just 5 that had 200 or more. And in the past 6 weeks this year, just in the last month and a half, every single program, all 6 of them, have brought in more than 166 requests, and 3 of those 6 have brought in more than 200. That makes the 6-week total in terms of phone calls, text messages, and orders online. That means that in just 6 weeks, we've had 1,288 requests for literature here in the UK. So it's been an especially strong month and a half for us, starting there in mid-March and carrying right through this month, the month of April. Our average weekly response for 2016 right now is 172, so that just keeps inching upward. A few weeks back, it was in the 140s, 150 range, and then now, because of this burst of activity in the last 6 weeks, we're now up to 172. That's a good average week in 2016. So some pretty exciting numbers to report, and hopefully we'll just continue to distribute as many pieces of literature over here as possible. This morning I previewed the program that we hope will play this coming weekend. I say hope because it has to go through the approval process, and the program is actually quite critical of television in general. So as I was thinking about it this morning, I just was hoping that the Ofcom people and the CBS managers that review the show, that they won't be too offended by the fact that, as I point out on this show, as we talked about last week on the radio, this really is not television's golden age. Far from it. It's a very dark age for TV right now. And if that goes to air, I hope, it's the kind of program that really will just help for people that view it here in the UK to think about how dramatic the changes have been. As I discussed with you all last week, just in the past 50 years or so, just in the past two generations, how much lower can we go in terms of the content and the themes and just the depressing and negative subjects that you just see routinely now on television and at the movies? Well, as I said last week, in many ways, it's a very accurate reflection of real society, of the real world, the world that so many people want to run away from, that so many people want to escape from. And so we immerse ourselves into entertainment, pleasure seeking, and meanwhile, the world is just off the rails. Richard Palmer has an article at the top of thetrumpet.com today, "The Dangerous Foreign Policy of America's Presidential Candidates." And he touches on some themes that we talked about last week on the radio, and that he's also talked about on Trumpet Hour. But still, you'll want to go and read it as well, and just really let it sink in. What's happening in the United States and where the United States is heading, whether it's coming from the conservative wing or the more liberal wing. Across the board, you're hearing, with maybe a few exceptions here and there, you're hearing this message, this clear message coming through that America needs to withdraw and that other nations need to step up and do more. They need to carry their weight. America has been bearing the burden of others for too long, and so we need to change things. Richard quotes from a New York Times piece that interviewed, or in which Donald Trump is interviewed, and it gives some insights into what he believes about letting Japan and South Korea build up their militaries, build up their nuclear arsenals, rather than having them depend on American might or power. The Times quotes Mr. Trump as saying, if the United States keeps on its path, its current path of weakness, they're going to want to have that anyway, with or without me discussing it. I mean, this is just the course that we're on. It's inevitable. So why should we keep paying the way? Trump believes. And so he's pushing for other nations to arm themselves. And he's not alone. Just like Richard brings out in his article, I mean, this has been quite common on both sides of the political landscape. Going back to administrations before President Obama's. This policy, this foreign policy, to push allies, and of course there are allies now, but like Richard Palmer brings out, how soon that could change. Pushing allies in Europe, to take another example, telling them to rearm. And of course, in Trump's case, he wants to disband NATO or to significantly revise it, which would then force Europe to go it alone. And really, you're already seeing signs of that happening now. Richard writes, Trump is encouraging the rise of a power that is currently a U.S. ally, but could easily become a rival once it becomes an independent military power, whether it's Europe or Japan. Trump has a lot of trust in America's allies. That's been a weakness for the United States. As I'll show you a little bit later with a clip by Herbert Armstrong, that has been a weakness. To place too much trust in allies. And he goes on to say, Richard does, that, you know, with a lot of Trump's beliefs or positions on social issues, he's just been all over the place. He's all over the map, back and forth. But on this point, his foreign policy, it's been pretty steady for the last many years, for the last decades, in fact. How much longer can the United States, again, bear the burden of others? Now, you look on the other side, in the Democratic wing, Hillary Clinton's the front runner there in front of Bernie Sanders, although he appears to be closing the gap. And she's criticized Trump for what he said about NATO, but if you look at things she said in her campaigning and while she was Secretary of State and before, she, too, wants Europe, the militaries of Europe, to step up and to defend themselves. Richard quotes her in the article, saying, there's also more they can do to share the burden with us. We'd like to see more European countries investing in defense and security, following the example of Germany and others that they've set during the Obama administration. Well, Richard goes on to talk about just the more common sentiment among the American people. I mean, you can see why the politicians are taking these positions. Because a large majority of Americans, they don't want to see the United States be the world's policeman anymore. They don't want to see the United States taking the lead militarily all over the world to maintain the stability that's been there for some 70 years. Since the end of World War II. They don't want to see this. Richard writes, for most, it isn't about America's allies. It's about a nation that has spent its strength in vain in the Middle East and is fed up with taking responsibility for the world. It no longer wants that burden. But if America does less, someone has to do more, Richard says. Stepping back from the world inevitably means having someone else step forward. And even those like Hillary Clinton, who want America to do more, also want Europe to do more. And then Richard says this, almost no one sees the danger here. No one sees the danger. Can the United States even see the danger or just the potential danger that's on the horizon? You know, trying to look at it from the leader's perspective. Where are the enemies of the United States today? Can the U.S. even see them? Or where are the potential enemies? I mean, with this particular administration, even the ones that are out there shouting every weekend that they want to destroy America, Iran, of course, the Obama administration is treating them like, well, they're an ally of ours. And we're really sticking it to Saudi Arabia. The president's going over there this week to try to mend the fences a little bit with Saudi Arabia. But Saudi Arabia, is absolutely beside itself at what the United States is doing to the Middle East. President Obama saying in that Atlantic article, that interview a few weeks back, that Saudi Arabia basically needs to step aside and make room for Iran in the neighborhood. That's the position that the U.S. is currently maintaining. And then criticizing Saudi Arabia in that same interview as being a free rider. I'm sure that didn't set well with the royals over there. But going back to the larger point, I mean, where are there any potential enemies that the United States is, preparing for, let's say? Almost no one sees the danger of this push. Hillary Clinton says, look, more nations in Europe, they need to do what Germany's been doing. Follow Germany's example. And, Germany's not there yet. There's still a lot more military might to come in the Bundeswehr. There was that report last week you might have seen about the ex-Bundeswehr soldiers that have since joined ISIS. I think 29 of them, perhaps. And so this is setting off some alarm bells in the German military leadership. You have others. There was this report from a German publication. Donna Courier. That's probably not how you pronounce that. At any event, it was translated for us in our news bureau. But it quotes the head of the Bundeswehr Association, René Wüstner, who's calling for a massive strengthening of the German army. Wüstner's quoted in this piece as saying, it's high time that the Bundeswehr intensifies the topic of cyber war, and it needs to create suitable structures. We've got to get ready. We went through that piece last week where the French president is calling on Germany to do more as well, saying that we can't rely on the United States anymore. Even though they're a friend, we've got to do it ourselves. This comes from the German publication, NTV, April 11th, protection on eastern NATO's borders. It says the Bundeswehr is increasingly being used in Eastern Europe. Each time the combined NATO forces in Poland and the Baltic states practice for the real thing. Since the beginning of the Ukraine crisis, the Eastern NATO partners in particular feel increasingly threatened by their powerful Russian neighbor. And of course, the United States has pretty much abandoned those nations in the East. And so who are they turning to? The German army. GermanForeignPolicy.com also. It had a post just the other day about the German army and the German government expanding Germany's efforts in Mali, the nation in Africa, a nation that's seen one terrorist attack after another. And so Germany is expanding its involvement. And as Richard brings out in his article at thetrumpet.com today, they're being encouraged to do so, as are other nations, encouraged by the United States, encouraged by the Obama administration, encouraged by Donald Trump, encouraged by Hillary Clinton. Richard quotes from that piece we went through last week, the one at the American Interest by Walter Russell Mead, where he talked about, yes, the United States has paid a significant portion of money to have such a big military since the end of World War II. But he says here, what's forgotten, and we read this last week, I know, but it's worth repeating here. He says, what's forgotten among all the grousing by President Obama and Donald Trump about free-riding allies is this basic fact of international life. The Pax Americana was intended to suppress global geopolitical and military competition by providing a framework for international security. It was a heavy cost. But look at the international security, the world stability that was there since the end of World War II. And Walter Mead says that, people who don't know much about history and are just looking at the bottom line now financially are saying that, well, we've paid everything. And there's some truth to that. But look at what it, look at what we were able to get in return. He says here, this is Walter Russell Mead, that with other powers spending less in their military, the bitter experience, it says, of the past that teaches an important lesson. Multipolar arms races lead to great power war. This is the reason America spent so much to be the world policeman. And why other powers spending so much less on the military is or was a good thing. Because the bitter experience of the past teaches an important lesson, which is what? Multipolar arms races lead to great power war. And that's what we're seeing happen now. That the United States is withdrawing. That the United States is isolating itself. That the United States is hollowing out its military. There's now an arms race. We've talked about this before on this program as well. People don't see the danger here. All of these leaders, look, it's time for you to step up. And if it's a problem in Europe's backyard, well, let Europe take care of it. If it's a problem in Southeast Asia, well, let South Korea or Japan take care of it. How short-sighted it is. And look, what does it say about just the average American's understanding of history? It's a very simple point to be made, as Richard brings out in the article. If America does less, someone's going to do more. And you're already seeing that happen. That's the thing. And is it a good thing? Open your eyes. See what's happening in Eastern Europe. See what's happening in Southeast Asia. See what's happening in the Middle East. You can see why Saudi Arabia is so upset. It's already happening. If America does less, someone else is going to do more. Now, a point Herbert Armstrong made years ago, he wrote about this in The Plain Truth, and he also said it on the radio. I'll play a clip in just a second. But he talked about that American weakness of just being able to see one enemy at a time. Richard touches on this in his article. You know, the enemy in World War II, Germany, Japan. But our friend, our ally, was Russia. Notice what Mr. Armstrong had to say. This is in one of his old radio programs on the Outline of Prophecy.
Now, prophecy gives a general broad outline of the events that are taking place on the earth now and those that are going to happen. It does specifically tell us of one of the phases of World War that we believe is now the next one that we will call World War III. And it is not coming from the power and the source that we seem to suspect. No, we in the United States, my friends, seem to be so stupid we never can tell where our real enemy is until after he strikes. We can only see one enemy at a time, and I want to tell you that the United States has more than one enemy. Now, we fought a war against Germany, World War II, and Japan. Of course, we said at the beginning of World War II that we would certainly do away with German militarism and it would never rise up its ugly head again. We were going to demolish it once and for all, and after we got it demolished, now we start to rise it up ourselves because we think we have to have it as a buffer and a protection against Russia. And some of us, my friends, know not only what we see when we're over there, but we know also what is prophesied. And we know what is prophesied to rise up in Europe. And we know which is the one and the only nation in Europe that is capable of dominating, and which is the economic and the industrial heart of all Europe, without which there could be no stability and strength. A human body cannot live without its heart. And the economic and the military body that is to rise up and to restore the Roman Empire, the thing that we least suspect here in the United States, it cannot rise up without its heart. And its heart is in Germany.
Now, that's just history. That's just history. And it's not even that long ago. And so, you've heard on this program, you've read at thetrumpet.com in our literature, you've heard from Mr. Armstrong himself, preparing us for this resurrection of the beast power, the prophesied beast power coming out of the heart of Europe, dominated by Germany. Now again, just stepping back and looking at the world at large, you see this piece from the Wall Street Journal yesterday, and it's right in line with what Richard Palmer was talking about at thetrumpet.com today and what we spoke about last week on the radio. It's from Mark Helprin talking about how the candidates, all of them, are ignoring the rising military dangers in the world. They're all ignoring this. In fact, they're saying, hey, it doesn't matter if there's other dangers emerging. Let the people in that part of the world take care of it. Why should we worry about it? Why should we pay for it? Helprin says this in the Wall Street Journal. In this powerful nation with founding principles and latent capacities second to none, politics have become fit for the fall of Rome. The culture is sick with self-destruction, and the rule of law is routinely perverted. Though politics, culture, and law are the arc of the nation, the keystone without which they cannot hold is defense. For war transforms whole peoples and threatens their sovereignty and national existence more decisively than any other force. And you've got to be ready for that. That's just the reality in this violent and divided world today. War transforms whole peoples and threatens their sovereignty and national existence more decisively than any other force. And he says here, you would hardly know this from the current presidential campaign. He says here that most candidates seem unaware of the prospect of catastrophic war in the not-too-distant future. They don't see it as a problem. They don't see it as a big concern. Look at what they're talking about. Look at what they're debating, particularly on the Democrat side. But even still, I mean, you look at the Republicans, and as we just read there or reviewed there with Richard's piece, look at what Mr. Trump is saying. Helprin says here, this is in the Wall Street Journal, Russia, China, and Iran have been racing ahead, stimulated by a disintegrating Europe that neither spends sufficiently on its defense nor defends its borders. And so you can get an underlying message coming from Helprin as well, even though this is a strong article, urging Europe to defend itself, urging Europe to defend its borders. But it's not just a disintegrating Europe that has these other powers racing to fill the vacuum. Most significantly, it's the United States. Again, look at the failure, the many failures, in fact, in the Middle East. Or as Helprin says here, the surrenders, the apologies, the bluffs, the leading from behind, denigrating its military capacity and morale, and opposing enemies only with exquisite delicacy. Just like we discussed last week. Now that's an inconsistency. We really wish Russia wouldn't do that. That was very dangerous. That's the strongest response the U.S. can muster to, well, pretty much an act of war. Certainly a provocative act, a belligerent act. Helprin says, as the U.S. allows its nuclear forces to stagnate and decay into de facto unilateral disarmament, Russia's been modernizing its own. The Kremlin has added systems such as road mobile, intercontinental ballistic missiles with independently targetable reentry warheads that we neither have nor envision. We're not even preparing for it. In the absence of soft power parity with the U.S., Russia dangerously relies on a permissive nuclear doctrine and promiscuously rattles its atomic sabers. Its nuclear adventurism, naval and land force modernization, unopposed reintroduction into the Middle East, invasion and annexation in Ukraine, and the ability to recapture the Baltic states in an afternoon are yet another impeachment of the end of history. That's what many were saying back in the 90s. Well, we've reached the end of history. We're now entering into this extended period of peace and prosperity. Globalism, everyone's connected. Well, you still hear the Obama administration talking as if that's the case today. The world's safer, more educated, and so on and so forth. He goes on and says, Halperin does, with little resistance, China incrementally annexes the South China Sea while embarked on a naval buildup inversely proportional to the smallest U.S. fleet since 1916, and further aggravated by China's ability, once its naval technology matures, to surge production in its 106 major shipyards as opposed to America's 6. 106-6. And so where is this trend heading? As you have America downsizing and the leaders saying, that's what we want, that's what we need. I mean, you hear Mr. Trump talk a lot about the military when he speaks of the veterans. But what about seeing any of these dangers or potential dangers on the horizon? He's basically saying, just let it blow up and let others clean up the mess. Is that a good thing? Is that going to make the world safer? Well, there's quite a few in the United States that firmly believe that. Halperin says, more importantly, China's expanding its nuclear forces. To what extent, we do not know, because the Chinese program's infrastructure is hidden within 3,000 miles of tunnels, largely opaque to U.S. intelligence. As if China were not a major rival, the Obama administration, ever infatuated with accords, has made no effort to include Beijing in a nuclear arms control regime. Why not? Why not? Then he says here, we pay Iran for allowing us to stabilize its acquisition of nuclear armaments and discount both the North Korean threat and missile defense, the only means of opposing it. Iran, by the way, you may have seen the big display or parade they had yesterday, I think it was, with that missile defense system that they received from Russia. The one that Russia held off on giving to them while the sanctions were in place. But now, I mean, that those sanctions have been lifted, here comes this very capable, modern air defense system. And they are proudly displaying it. And the United States pitches in helpfully, giving them $150 billion. It says here later, should these trends continue unaddressed, the world will see three great powers, China, Russia, the U.S., each with a complex and shifting system of alliances in unstable areas, subject to proxy wars and opportunistic territorial expansion, the beginnings of which are now apparent in Ukraine, Syria, and the South China Sea. You're already seeing it. We're already seeing it, aren't we? He goes on and talks about some history leading up to the outset of World War I. Later, he says, this is Mark Halperin, with rapid shifts in the correlation of forces among near equals, nations seeking protection will migrate among the blocks and arm to protect themselves, provoking their neighbors to do the same. Such conditions absent since World War II will be remarkably unstable, especially given the emergence of semi-medieval crazy states armed with nuclear warheads on ICBMs. These conditions that have been absent since World War II make the world remarkably unstable. Now, why were those conditions, firstly, absent since the end of World War II? Well, you go back to what Walter Meade said at the American Interest. And the fact that Pax Americana was intended to suppress global geopolitical and military competition by providing a framework for international security. Well, that framework has now shattered. And it's every man for himself. And that makes the world now remarkably, remarkably unstable. Let me read you the conclusion here of Halperin's piece. Further on, it says the U.S. 2015 base budget defense appropriation, excluding overseas contingency spending, was just less than 3%, as opposed to 5.7% in the peacetime years during the period 1940 to 2000. And so, again, we've talked about people that come forward and say, well, you look at how much the U.S. still spends on its military. But where is it going? And look at how that strength is being spent in vain, as we've covered so many times. But look at just the size of the Navy, as Halperin brings out in his piece earlier. And then now this, the budget defense appropriation in peacetime years from 1940 to 2000, it amounted to 5.7% of the budget. Today it's 3%. And so you go back and ask, well, why was it so stable from 1945 on, for a period of 50, 60 years. And then look at the direction today. 3%. Halperin says, though embarrassingly, it would take Churchillian statesmanship to return merely to the norm. Doing so would help arrest the slide toward a perilous international system such as existed before World War I. But in a presidential campaign in which most candidates and their partisans see only what is at their feet, perhaps it's too much to expect that they look toward the horizon. Look at what's being debated. Look at what makes the news during this presidential campaign, and in some cases for weeks on end. A debate, a back and forth about some of the stupidest topics you could imagine. Where are there the leaders that are looking toward the horizon, that see the potential for danger, the potential for one of America's so-called allies to quickly turn into a competitor, an enemy? Well, when you look at how things are breaking down economically, for example, you can see why there is so much pressure on these leaders, these potential leaders of the United States, to focus strictly on what the needs are at home, to focus strictly on the economy. Time magazine had a piece, I guess it's going into its April 25th issue, The United States of Insolvency. This is by James Grant, an economist. He wrote a book recently on the Forgotten Depression, 1921. But he says here, he talks about the $14 trillion that the U.S. is going to have to pay back. Of course, the national debt, as you can see on the famous debt clock, it's up over $19 trillion, and that extra $5 trillion is basically money that the United States has loaned to itself. Funny money, monopoly money. And he says here, James Grant says, I mean, that may be a debt that the U.S. doesn't really feel compelled to pay back anytime soon. But when you have others, individuals or nations that own almost $14 trillion of our debt, what happens when the government has to pay, the federal government in the United States has to pay its creditors? If you've read our material for a long time, you'll remember the alarm that Tim Thompson sounded back in the 1990s. When those allies, quote unquote, turn to enemies, and they use this incredible amount of debt, this unprecedented debt, against us. You may have heard Saudi Arabia just this past week issue a financial threat, an economic threat, because of this 9/11 commission, these pages that were classified that many are wanting to be declassified, pages that supposedly are going to show how Saudi Arabia was before or behind, rather, more than what has been commonly known. And so Saudi Arabia responds and says, look, if you put the blame on us, here's what we're going to do. This is a nation that for the longest time was what many would consider to be one of America's strongest allies in the Middle East. And look at how fast that can change. And so going back to what Richard covers in his piece, what about Japan? What about Germany? I mean, these were enemies just 70 years ago. And yet we carry on as if, oh, it can never happen again. They're just going to be our allies from here on out. Well, in this piece, coming back to the state of our economy, he says here, $13.9 trillion. It's unmanageable. It says, what is important is that the government pay its public creditors on time. So cast your eyes on the exact numerical rendering of that slightly smaller sum, slightly smaller than $19 trillion, that is, $13.9 trillion. Between the fiscal years 2008 and 2012, federal deficits totaled $5.6 trillion. The national debt nearly doubled in the span of the same span of years to $11.2 trillion. The Federal Reserve tickled $1.6 trillion in new digital dollars into existence. True, our Great Recession proved no Great Depression, but the post-2008 recovery is the limpest on record. He says here, a thin cheer went up in January when the deficit, calculated over the 12 preceding months, weighed in at a mere $405 billion. The lowest over any 12-month period since 2008, only $405 billion. It's not so much as Washington strums its calculators. And then Mr. Grant says here, let's pause to reflect that a billion is 1,000 million and that a trillion is 1,000 billion, or alternatively, 1,000,000,000,000. It's a measure of the fix we're in that the billions hardly seem worth talking about anymore. It's only $405 billion. That's low. That's low compared to the last 12 months. Shocking, isn't it? Should be, anyway. Mr. Grant says, you can't blame people for not paying attention. America has forever defied the doomsayers. The very language of government debt is calculated to tranquilize the critical mind. We speak of the Department of the Treasury rather than the Department of the Debt. We say entitlement instead of taxing Peter to pay Paul. And Social Security Trust Fund when we mean just another ordinary government account at the Department of Debt. Today's miniature interest rates constitute another form of public sedation. You'd suppose the doubling of the debt would jack up the cost of servicing the debt. Nothing of the kind. As the debt has doubled, the rate of interest has halved. So you perform all of these tricks. Try to keep interest rates artificially low, printing off funny money. And as he says, you can see why people aren't paying attention, because it seems like that for years now, America has forever defied the doomsdayers. For years, it's defied the doomsdayers. Well, here's what Mr. Grant says. We owe more than we can easily repay. We spend too much and borrow too much. Worse, we promise too much. We conjure dollar bills by the trillions, pull them right out of thin air. I won't insist that this can't go on, because it has. I'll only say that it will eventually stop. It will eventually stop. A day of reckoning is coming. But yet people go to sleep and think that, well, we've lived on debt for so long. I mean, why can't we just continue on with this? Why can't it keep going? Jeremiah chapter 30. Let me just take you through a few scriptures here in this very detailed chapter about the days ahead for the descendants of ancient Israel. This well-known verse, verse 7, talks about Jacob's trouble. I'll get to that in just a second if we have time. But starting here at the beginning of the chapter, it says, "The word that came to Jeremiah from the Eternal, saying, Thus speaks the Lord God of Israel, saying, Write you all the words that I've spoken unto you in a book. For lo, verse 3, the days come, says the Eternal, that I will bring again the captivity of my people, Israel and Judah, says the Eternal." So it's addressed to Israel and Judah. Of course, at the time of this writing, Israel had gone into captivity already, about 100 years earlier. So this wasn't fulfilled anciently. I mean, only in type, if you look at that ancient history. It's really for the latter days. It says it at the end of the chapter. Look at verse 24. "In the latter days you shall consider it." This whole book, not just chapter 30, the whole book's for the end time. Well, he's speaking according to, or concerning, rather, Israel and Judah, as it says there in verse 4. Verse 5, "For thus says the Eternal, we've heard a voice of trembling, of fear, and not of peace. Ask you now, and see whether a man does travail with child. Wherefore do I see every man with his hands on his loins, as a woman in travail, and all faces are turned into paleness." That's what's coming upon our peoples. It's called a day of Jacob's trouble, or a time of Jacob's trouble. Jacob is the name of Israel before his conversion. And so that's talking about a time of trouble coming upon our peoples. Mr. Armstrong in the United States and Britain in prophecy, he proved who the people of Jacob or Israel anciently are today. He said in this letter back in 1978 that God had revealed this truth to him about the lost 10 tribes. Those descendants that had migrated into Western Europe, Britain, and then finally the United States. He said in that 78 letter, "When prophecy tells us this is to be the time of Jacob's trouble, that means primarily the United States and the British people. It's the worst trouble our peoples have ever experienced. Even worse, if you can imagine. Even worse than World War II. Now, listen to what Herbert Armstrong had to say about this verse, about this passage, Jacob's trouble. This is from a radio broadcast, again, back in the early 60s.
"That great tribulation is the time of whose trouble, my friends? Jacob. Now, who is Jacob? Where is Jacob today? It isn't just the time of Jewish trouble. Do you think that there are enough Jews in the world, about 15 or 17 million Jewish people? Do you think there are enough of them, with a few that are in Palestine, the rest scattered in all the nations over the earth, that just a trouble on them will be the greatest time of trouble that has ever happened in the world? I should say not. No, but when it involves the British Commonwealth of Nations, when it involves the whole United States as well as all the Jewish people, when it involves all of the democratic nations of Northwestern Europe, then I tell you, my friends, we're getting into the worst time of trouble that this world has ever known, and that's exactly what your Bible is talking about."
That's from his old radio program, talking about Jacob's trouble. And then just to tie this back in with what we discussed there at the beginning of the show, America's weakness, great weakness of being able to just see as Mr. Armstrong said, one enemy at a time. Drop down to verse 12. Here in Jeremiah 30, it says, "For thus says the Eternal, your bruise is incurable." This is talking about the sickness in our nations. "Your wound is grievous. There's none to plead your cause, that you may be bound up. You have no healing medicines." The only way out, you see, is by turning to God in repentance. But we've since passed the point of no return. And God says in verse 14, all your lovers have forgotten you. They seek you not, for I have wounded you with the wound of an enemy, with the chastisement of a cruel one, for the multitude of your iniquity, because your sins were increased. All of your lovers, the Moffat translation says, all of your allies, they have forgotten you. Those people that you think you're close to, those nations that you think are allies, that you're saying, you go and defend yourself, we'll support you verbally, but we can't bear that burden any longer. You take care of yourself. And there's coming a time when those friends, those allies, those lovers, as they're called here in verse 14, they are going to forget all about the United States and Britain. Here's one last clip from Mr. Armstrong's radio broadcast.
"For thus says the Eternal, your hurt is incurable, and your wound is grievous. There is none to uphold your cause, no medicine for your wound, no healing for you." He says this to our people of the United States. This is for us today, my friends. This is a prophecy. This is not some old, dead, and gone ancient history. This is a live, living prophecy, an energized prophecy under the inspiration of God Almighty, and it's for us, and this is the message of God. This is the thus saith the Eternal. "All your allies have forgotten you. They care nothing for you, for I have dealt you the blow of an enemy." Our allies. All right, your lovers, your allies, Germany and Japan, don't care anything for you, and they're going to forget us too.
Well, he lists them off specifically there. These allies that we've propped up since the end of World War II, when, of course, then they were our enemies. They're going to forget. These are prophecies for the end time. In the latter days, you shall consider it. But back up for a moment to see where all of this is leading. We can't forget about this. Here it is, tucked into the middle of this passage, this chapter, verse 8. It says, "For it shall come to pass in that day, says the Eternal of hosts, that I will break his yoke from off your neck, and I will burst your bonds, and strangers shall no more serve themselves of him, but they shall serve the Lord their God and David their king, whom I will raise up unto them." So in this time of Jacob's trouble, you see there the yoke of captivity, of slavery. The latter-day descendants of ancient Israel serving foreigners in captivity. And this is all, going back to the time frame, it's all just before the resurrection of David to be king over Israel throughout the millennium. Now you think about this, when Jeremiah wrote this prophecy down, David had been dead for some 400 years. So it's obviously talking about one last captivity for the descendants of Israel and Judah. As mentioned there in verse 3, "I will bring again the captivity of my people, Israel and Judah." But remember the time frame. It leads right into the return of Christ, the resurrection of King David in the United States and Britain in prophecy. Mr. Armstrong says, so the time is just prior to Christ coming to liberate our peoples, even as Moses liberated ancient Israel from Egyptian slavery. That's the time now, just ahead of us. The terrifying madness of man's rule over man is about to end, and God will rule man. Finally, the way man should have been ruled from the very beginning. with God's authority, with God's government, with God's kingdom in place. And Jesus Christ serving as King of Kings and Lord of Lords, as it says in the book of Revelation. Some pretty exciting prophecies for sure, even though it's going to get a lot worse before it gets better. This is what it culminates in, the resurrection of King David, the return of Jesus Christ to this earth. You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show on KPCG 101.3 on the FM dial. Tomorrow I hope to get into some additional stats and figures that many of you seem to be always interested in, besides just the weekend stats from the TV program. We're going to talk a little bit more about some of the listeners, the amount that we have, and just some of the stats, and also some feedback coming from you listeners as well. If you'd like to continue with that, sending us more feedback, that is, send those messages to td@kpcg.fm. Hey, thanks for joining us today, and we'll see you again tomorrow.